You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, August 24th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we are being joined by a special guest rogue this week, Aran Segev. Aran, welcome back to the SGU.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Steve.
And Aran is from the Australian Skeptics, but at this moment you're not in Australia. You're actually here in Connecticut, visiting
UK.
And you came to the U.S. chasing the solar eclipse, right?
I did. I joined a group headed by Pamela Gay and Fraser Kane. We met in St. Louis about, I think it was something like hundreds of us.
Sounds like a musical.
And then on the day of the eclipse, we drove down to Carbondale, southern Illinois, and watched the eclipse there.
You were there with Pamela?
Sort of. So we were in two different locations.
I almost cried.
Well,
I almost cried for Pamela. To me, it was a near worst-case scenario for eclipse viewing.
Well, it's Pamela's fault, actually, because it turns out that Pamela, this was her first, her fourth attempt at a total solar eclipse.
No!
For a total time of about 9 minutes, and so far she's 0 seconds for 9 minutes.
Wow.
I didn't think it could get worse. It was literally her fourth attempt, and that sounds like my luck with astronomical
Wait. Tell us what happened.
I was in the other bus. We went to some open field only a couple of miles away, and I got to see all of totality. About 3 minutes before totality, the clouds cleared for the final time, and we had all of totality. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
Well, let me tell you what I saw on TV looking at Pamela. You had a pretty good view of the totality approaching. And then a few minutes before the clouds start coming in, then it all disappeared for like a minute or two. And then it came back right before totality. It was just, the edge was disappearing. And then right pretty much at the moment that totality hit, or a few seconds before, the clouds came in force, completely obscuring the entire thing. And we're waiting because we knew we had Cannondale had like the longest totality, like two minutes 40 seconds,
yeah.
And then it cleared pretty much at the precise moment that totality ended. It cleared, and it was like seeing the build up and the after effects are fun. But totality is the nut. That's it. That's what you came to see. And that was completely wiped away. But the timing was like a big smack in the face. Sorry, well, I would not be stoic about that. I would be like, what the F just happened?
She's just used to it.
Oh, that's so sad. So a famous essayist, I know I sent the essay to you, Evan, and you read it before we both got to view it. She once said that partial eclipse has no relation to a total eclipse. A partial eclipse relates to a total eclipse like flying in an airplane relates to falling out of one.
Yes.
Wow.
That's very good.
It's a world of difference.
It's so different. And, I had people sending in. So I hosted a live stream with National Geographic and an astronaut named Terry Virts. He's a former space station commander, and he had never seen a total eclipse from Earth. He had seen them from space, which is basically looking down and seeing the moon's shadow, which is pretty crazy, but it's still nothing like, I mean, it's crazy because he's in space, but it's still nothing like experiencing totality on the ground. And so we were in it together, and we had no idea how we were going to react. I burst into tears. He got emotional, but, he didn't cry. I mean, it was really, for me, a life-changing experience to be able to see that. And I got multiple people writing in that said, when it happened for me, like let's say they were in Texas or something, when I saw the eclipse, I cried. And I was thinking, wow, like when I saw the partial eclipse, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then when totality happened, it was like insanity. It was absolute insanity. There was a hole in the sky. There was a 360-degree sunset. It was navy blue outside. It was a color I'd never seen. Birds started freaking out. All the people on the cliffside next to us were losing their minds and like howling and screaming and crying and laughing. And I didn't want to make any of my friends who didn't make it out feel bad for it, but I wanted to impress upon them how important it is for them to see it in 2024.
Oh, yeah, you made me feel like shit. I regretted
it. I didn't mean to.
I regretted it even more than I had. I was like, you know, well, how the hell did I miss this? And there's nothing that's going to stop me from seeing it in 2024 except death.
Oh, I'm literally ready to buy my ticket to Argentina to see it next year.
2019.
In 2019. Like, I think I'm going to become one of those crazy eclipse chasers, you guys. I'm converted. What about you, Evan?
Wow. Oh, my gosh. If I didn't have to hold down a real daytime job, I would be there with you. And I would chase these things all over the planet, no doubt about it. No, people I was with were also quite emotional, Yeah. I held it together, barely.
But your wife cried.
Oh, yes, she absolutely did. Tears of joy.
I didn't hold back. I cried. This was my second eclipse, which is a bit of a problem because, you see, I think it's easy to stop at one. You say, okay, I've experienced this now, but now having traveled this far for a second one, I'm not sure I can stop at two. I think I now need to start chasing those things. But even just hearing you describe this now, Kara, I was all goosebumps just from the description. It really is a life-changing experience.
The eclipse is an indescribable sort of thing. I don't think pictures can't really do it justice. Describing it as best as you can has a hard time doing it justice.
Yeah.
But I will say
this. You have to be there.
I will say this. It's essentially you're standing on a different planet for those minutes. Mm-hmm. It's a different world. It just is.
It's alien because the sun doesn't it rises in the east and it sets in the west. That's what we know. That's what we're trained on. And so when the sun is all around you but not bathing you in its warmth, and there's a direct nightness overhead and you can see the stars, but it's all a strange color. And also, guys, you can't see the moon. That's something that we don't realize. The moon is backlit by the sun. Mm-hmm. It's black.
It has no features.
Yeah. It's a new moon. That's the only way that you can recognize that it is the moon is if you can see well enough to see Bailey's beads, because these little pops of light that come up around the outside as the eclipse as totality is starting and then finishing, those actually represent the craters on the moon. That's, you know, it's an uneven surface. That's why they pop out. But other than that, you can't see it. So it looks like there's a hole in the sky. Well, and if you look at the map, I think Time magazine did one and a lot of other people did coverage of like, this is the next, you know, 10 eclipses or here's the next eclipses for the next 50 years across the United States. Iran, you get like a bunch of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's something like four.
Yeah.
In Australia.
Well, I was going to say that you're all invited to Sydney 2028.
Great. Awesome. I'm there.
Wow. Yeah, Rod, seriously, you should come stay with me and whatever plans that we have for 2024. I mean, you're always, of course, welcome here, especially since, you know, I'm almost going to be in the line of totality, or at least within a drive from it.
I accept now.
Okay, you're in.
Guys, Argentina and Chile get an eclipse in 2019 and 2020.
The heck?
Wow. Yeah,
I know.
That's
it's a different path,
lucky,
but it's not
countries.
Fair.
It's not fair.
Or in 2021, we could go to Antarctica. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Antarctica?
That sounds like two in one.
I know.
You know when Connecticut's next total solar eclipse will be?
When?
2099.
Oh, my God.
And 2026, it's going to go over the Arctic. It's going to be over Greenland and Iceland. Can you imagine? What if, like, the northern lights were going off during a solar eclipse?
Oh,
I would
God.
Lose
whoa.
My mind.
Whoa. That could be.
Are there aurora reports? Like, I don't know anything about aurora. Can we calculate when they're going to occur?
No, they're kind of random
events.
No,
it's totally random.
But
gotcha.
It's like predicting the weather. You know, maybe you get like a day's notice or something if there's going to be a lot of activity. And then
It depends on some on the Earth's magnetic field and on solar activity mostly.
But what an incredible random fluke if the sun and the moon align such that the moon is 400 times closer while the sun is 400 times bigger and they're the exact same size. And on top of that, there are, you know, northern or southern lights. Like, that would be insane.
It's actually not that big a coincidence.
Yeah, you're putting about it.
You mean for an eclipse to happen?
To have an arrangement where eclipses can happen.
No, yeah, but to have it happen over one particular place on the globe is quite yeah. rare. So it
once every 375 years. That's how. Yeah. That's the average. I said one time at 375 years, any particular spot on the globe will have this total solar.
The apparent size of the sun and the moon overlap for about 1% of the Earth's lifespan.
Gotcha.
So 1%. Right. You know, given that we have a moon.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Know, but yeah,
that's
not,
a lot.
It's not that. It's not as not but as in, astronomical as you might think.
In what, like 300 million years, 600 million years, we
it's
won't
over.
Have any more eclipses.
Not
yeah, it's over.
Not,
the moon will be...
Not total. Yeah, there'll be annular
not
eclipses.
Not total.
Yeah.
Always annular, yeah.
It'll be too far away.
Unless we have the technology to pull the moon back.
Right.
maybe. You never know.
All right. Well, let's move on with our show. Bob, you're going to start with the Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
Yes, for this week's Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Mary Baltz Tyler, who was the first woman soil scientist in the field for the USDA Soil Conservation Service. Now, you know, I almost gave up on Mary. I could not find much on her at all. No Wikipedia entry. Couldn't find out, you know, when she was born and when she died. And I was just like, well, there's just not enough information out there. And then I said, you know, that makes me want to talk about her even more, even with just the little information I was able to find. Somebody had to speak for her, especially after I saw an entry in Reddit. Somebody said, this is my grandmother, Mary Tyler, first female soil scientist, touring upstate farms to save America from the Dust Bowl, 1935.
Wow.
And that's like one of the few pictures I found of her. So here's some of the things that I was able to find beyond that. Mary Baltz graduated from Cornell University. There was a labor shortage during World War II, which provided openings for her that normally would have gone to a man. Not a surprising scenario at all. She joined the Soil Survey as a junior soil surveyor in 1946. And ultimately, as I said, she was the first woman soil scientist, mapping all of Madison and Oneida counties in New York by 1951. Eventually, she was assigned the task of map measurement for the entire state of New York and hiring a team of women to help during the winter season, during the period of time where they worked indoors. So remember Mary Baltz. Try to find out even more about her and let me know what you find. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing edaphology, pedology, or, of course, hydric soils.
Thank you, Bob. All right, Kara, you're going to start us off with the news items, talking about the relationship between taking vitamin supplements and cancer risk. Not what you might think.
Absolutely. So there's an interesting study that was done in the Washington State area. It was recently published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And the title is Long-Term Supplemental One-Carbon Metabolism-Related Vitamin B Use in Relation to Lung Cancer Risk in the Vitamins and Lifestyle Vital Cohort. So Vital is a survey that was given out to individuals. Vital meaning standing in for vitamins and lifestyle. And this was a survey that was given out. It was given out to 77,118 participants. So a really big pool of individuals, all between the ages of 50 and 76 years of age. And this survey has a lot of measures on it. So we've got to, you know, hold that in your memory banks as we start to talk about some of the limitations of the study. But it's got a lot of different measures. And basically, it asks people about their vitamin and supplement use and asked about all these different vitamins and supplements. And then the researchers looked at the data that came back from that survey and they were able to link it to data that came back from a cancer registry in the same area. It started in between 2000 and 2002, and I think they followed these people for 10 years. They found that of the 77,118 participants that they gave the survey to, it crossed with the cancer registry at an N of 808, meaning that 808 people had invasive lung cancer and had also filled out this vitamin surgery. So they're like, okay, we're going to take these 808 invasive lung cancer patients and we're going to look at their vitamin use and see what's going on with that. And they found that across this 10-year average, taking B vitamins was actually associated with, and I need to make that firm because this does not show any causality whatsoever, but taking B vitamins, specifically vitamin B6 and vitamin B12, in levels that were significantly higher than what's recommended for your daily dosage, were associated with significant increases in lung cancer risk. Now, here's some interesting components of that. There was no difference in women who took these B vitamins and their lung cancer risk. It only seemed to happen in men. And it was specific to the different vitamins. I have some numbers here that I want to tell you. First, let's talk about how much these people were taking. Men were taking, they looked at the highest dosage group to calculate some of these numbers. So men who were taking more than 20 milligrams of vitamin B6, and keep in mind that the average recommended daily allowance is 1.7 milligrams per day. So this is, you know, more than 10 times over. They were at an 80% higher risk of developing lung cancer than those who did not take greater than 20 milligrams per day of vitamin B6. And then when it came to vitamin B12, those who had taken greater than 55 micrograms per day, when the average recommended daily allowance is 2.5 micrograms, so again, that's a massive dose compared to what is recommended for us to take, they were showing a 98% greater risk of lung cancer. So overall, they were showing a 30 to 40% increase in lung cancer risk among men. Women did not show a significant difference. Now, what we've got to make sure that we point to is the fact that many of these men who had an increased lung cancer risk were smokers. So keep that in mind. But the highest increase was actually among smokers. So we saw an even higher risk when, an even higher risk of cancer in the men who took a lot of vitamin B6 and a lot of vitamin B12. And we saw an even higher risk in people who smoked at baseline. So it wasn't just that, oh, it was a sampling error and all the people who smoked happened to have the lung cancer. They even looked at the differences between smokers who took B6 and B12 and non-smokers who took B6 and B12. And they looked at the difference between smokers who took B6 and B12 and smokers who didn't take vitamins. And they took all that into account. So here's some limitations of the study, though. There's no way to know whether or not there's a causal link here. We know that, right? Because we're just looking at population data. It's totally correlational. It could be that these people knew that they had a risk of smoking, of cancer from smoking, so they intentionally took vitamins because they thought it would help fend it off. Who knows? It could be that these people would be more likely to enter into a study on supplement use and take massive doses because we don't have any data on whether or not they were involved in studies. If you're diagnosed with lung cancer, you might be more likely to, you know, do whatever you can if you think it could help. There's just so many different confounds that could be present there. So that's one thing. Another thing, and we've talked about this multiple times on the show, it's not intentional p-hacking, but what happens when you run a bunch of different analyses out of the same data? You get a lot of false positives. So there's a chance that these associations are occurring because of chance. And the study authors know that, and they want people to replicate this study. Because when they look back at the literature, they found that the literature was really all over the place. Like there was a really big study in Europe called EPIC in 2010 that showed that higher blood levels of vitamin B6 were associated with a lower risk of lung cancer. And then in Norway in 2009, there was a big study where they gave doses of vitamin B to patients with heart disease for 39 months and found that it raised their risk of lung cancer. So this is why these researchers were interested in this. What is the relationship? Because it seems super unclear. And in this study, they found that it was quite a significant relationship, and actually taking mass doses of these B vitamins, specifically B6 and B12, were associated with a significant increase in your risk for lung cancer. But this needs to be replicated. We need to see if these data hold. But it's interesting, right? It's a little bit counterintuitive.
It's actually but it is very
superficial. It's not if you know about the one carbon metabolism pathway. So these researchers would, because here's the question, like, what the hell could be causing this?
Yeah.
Like, why, if this is a causal link, which we don't know, we can't say that for sure, why would taking B vitamins increase your risk of lung cancer? Well, there is a pathway, a biochemistry pathway. A lot of you who have taken biochemistry remember learning about these different metabolic pathways. And this one's involved in both amino acid metabolism, but also nucleotide metabolism. So it actually encodes, or it actually leads to changes in your DNA. And it involves these B vitamins. Specifically here, it's actually vitamin B12. I'm not sure if vitamin B6 is in the one carbon metabolism pathway. But so the authors are saying, hey, we don't know if this is causal, but if it is causal, maybe these vitamins are interfering with this pathway and causing changes to the DNA that increase the risk. And when you say, yeah, but why would it only happen in men? They say, maybe male hormones like androgens, testosterone, could have an interaction effect. This is the kind of stuff we want to study now at a more basic molecular level. So interesting. I mean, just an interesting finding, but also huge grain of salt with this. And let's make sure that when you come across the headlines, as you undoubtedly will, that say, don't take high doses of B vitamins. Don't drink those energy drinks. You'll get lung cancer. Right. That you're like, well, whoa, whoa, whoa.
But you
let's
shouldn't
calm down
do that,
a second.
You shouldn't take high doses of B vitamins.
Well, yeah, you shouldn't take doses of things over the recommended daily allowance anyway.
And B6 has a very narrow range, a narrow optimal range. And people overdose on it all the time. And not yeah, even and if like, you don't overdose on it, like you could have a high enough level that you're getting some toxic effect from it very easily. You know, some people are taking a multivitamin, a B vitamin, and then there's so many, it's fortified in so many different things. If you have a good diet, probably don't need to take any vitamins. If you think you might, have your primary care doctor check your levels and supplement accordingly. You know, target your levels. Don't just do it blind. You're likely to be overdosing.
Yeah.
Supplements are there for a reason. Like if an individual has a dietary, an allergy and they can't take certain things, or if you're like vegan or vegetarian and you've worked with your primary care physician, like, or your nutritionist even. So one of the study authors, Theodore Brasky, was actually interviewed in a write-up on this in Cosmos magazine. And the quote, I think, is like really telling. He says, again, to reiterate, the recommended daily allowance for B6 is about 1.5 milligrams. And for B12, it's less than 2.5 micrograms. Okay, this is the standard dosage for men. And here's his quote. But if you look at these supplement bottles, they're being sold in pill form at up to 5,000 micrograms per dose, which is much, much higher than the daily recommended amount. Energy drinks like Monster can carry up to 80 times the recommended daily allowance of B vitamins.
Yeah.
Crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's way too high.
Steve, at what point do we have to worry about vitamins being toxic?
Well, if you take a high enough dose, you know, even though they're nutritional supplements, at high enough dose, they start to act like drugs, you know? And at high enough dose, all vitamins have a toxic level. Some of them closer to their, you know, nutritional levels than
water
others.
Water has a toxic
level. Anything does, but it's just a matter of like how much higher than like what you could normally get. But like, as again, like with B6, you could get to toxic levels through ordinary amounts of supplements that you wouldn't think would be dangerous,
right.
You know? So, B12, it's a little bit harder, but you can absolutely do it, especially if you're taking things that have crazy amounts, like 5,000 micrograms, which is way more than most people need. So there's just no reason to do it blindly. But I would say, Kara, that there's other possible mechanisms by which vitamins can contribute to the risk of cancer. One is that, you know, cancers are highly metabolically active. They need to be fed too. They need vitamins too. And so in fact, you know, some people think that we should be trying to starve cancers by making sure that certain vitamin levels are on the low side, enough for you, enough for your healthy cells, but not enough for the highly metabolically active cancer cells. And if you take super high levels of vitamins, you may be just feeding your cancer.
Feeding the beast.
The other thing is that antioxidants might actually inhibit the immune system's ability to fight off cancer cells because, you know, one of the ways that we kill things is with oxygen-free radicals. And if you're scavenging them all up with antioxidants, it actually could impair the immune system. So
just stay away from antioxidants. It's not a miracle anything.
Oh, gosh. There's so many out there, though. There's so many things advertising it.
It's like we forget sometimes that we evolved mechanisms. And a lot of times when you look at the drugs and the supplements and the vitamins and the antioxidants and the probiotics that are marketed, there is a reason for people who have pathological physiology, right? Somebody who maybe their gut is not working appropriately, so their doctor works with them to find the right probiotics for their gut flora. Or there are individuals who maybe they have a suppressed immune system, so they have to take certain things. But for most of us, if we're eating the right foods and we're exercising and we're getting enough sleep, our bodies are like miracles, and we forget how incredibly good they are. Yes, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, change miracle with finely tuned machine.
There you go. How incredibly good they are at doing all this stuff. Yeah. And lots of times when you supplement on top of that, you're just, again, paying for really expensive pee because you're not going to metabolize them and you're just going to piss them out. Or, like you said, you're going to take them in toxic levels. Yeah. And bad things can happen.
Yeah. I mean, evolution is especially good at tweaking a system, right? At optimizing a system where all the pieces are in place. So, like, we have a balance between antioxidants and the need for free radicals and cell messaging and all these things. And evolution will tweak that homeostasis. And you're not going to make it suddenly function better because you're eating antioxidants. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It was naive to ever think that it would. And if anything, you're probably just going to make that optimized system worse. The only time where there's an exception to that, as you say, Kara, is if you have a disease, if your system is out of optimality for some reason or another, and you're trying to compensate for that, then sure. Like if you have a mutation where you're not making a natural antioxidant or something like that. But if you're, for a healthy person, to think that you're going to game this system that evolution has had hundreds of millions of years to tweak is a little naive.
Yeah.
But that's what all like the supplement industry's marketing is based on, basically. All right, let's move on. So speaking of all of this, actually, this is kind of along the same lines. Have you guys seen Panera Bread's latest marketing campaign?
No.
Oh, no.
Should I gird my loins?
Man, I kind of like Panera.
I know. Yeah. I kind of liked them too. And now it's like, I really don't think I can go to Panera. Iran, do you have, Panera in Australia?
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know what Panera Bread is, Panera Bread is a restaurant that has,
it's a restaurant and bakery, basically.
It's a bakery, yeah. But it does have a healthy kind of Starbucks vibe to it, like a trendy, healthy vibe to it.
And it's very good lunchy. It's lunchy. They have them around office buildings a lot. Like, you can go and get a soup and a salad or a salad and a sandwich for lunch.
Yeah, they make a killer PB&J, you know. But
yeah, and their soups are epic. Like, their broccoli cheese is really good.
Right.
Corn chowder.
It came out with this advertisement. Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, they went full food babe in this advertisement. Really.
They jumped the shark.
They fear monger about sodium benzoate. Sodium benzoate is a preservative that's perfectly safe.
It's in everything.
It's in everything. It is, it's in food, it is at levels which is orders of magnitude less than clearly established safety guidelines, right? So this is a completely benign preservative that poses zero health risk.
Steve, but I must ask you.
Go ahead.
But it sounds scary.
Yeah, so it's
chemically. It's chemically.
Yeah, sodium something or other. Ooh, not good.
It's almost as bad as sodium chloride. That has chlorine in it.
Oh, my gosh. dreaded chlor.
Dihydrogen monoxide.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop it. You're killing me.
So sodium benzoate, they show pictures of like a guy in a hazard suit and a gas mask with canisters of sodium benzoate, you know, and they say,
show that same picture with canisters of oxygen or carbon dioxide.
Yes,
Or liquid nitrogen,
Yeah. But also, can we take a second to talk about the fact that there's a reason we put preservatives in food?
Yeah, what do you call it? Preserves them.
Yeah, it like makes it so that you can have something on the shelf for longer than a day without it rotting.
Right.
Like, that's important to feed a growing population of people.
Yeah, we talked about that. Food waste is like 30%. Preservatives, are one way of trying to minimize that. If you get rid of preservatives because of baseless fear mongering, you're just going to make the food wastage problem worse.
If you buy anything in the grocery store that's in a package, unless it has a quote unquote natural preservative like salt, like pickles maybe would have with vinegar and salt, like it probably has sodium benzoate or some other type of preservative in it.
Yeah, this is food science. Ugh. Anyway, and then they do this is the food babe thing. They go, sodium benzoate is used in fireworks. It's an explosive.
So it's gonna either give you bad gas or blow you up. What?
Yeah.
But Steve, on the positive side, it's not used in yoga mats.
It's not used in yoga mats.
Yeah, right?
Good one.
fireworks require oxygen to explode.
You could make fireworks out of sodium chloride, too. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So, yeah, chemicals could be used for multiple things. You can combine them with other stuff, and you could make things like antifreeze or fireworks or yoga mats or whatever. It's all irrelevant. It says zero, nothing about whether or not it is safe in that one form in the amounts used in food. Nothing. So they completely food babe fearmonger about a completely safe preservative, sodium benzoate. Then they have their no-no list. No-no list of things that will never appear in any of their food. And it's just a bunch of normal stuff used for food production, right? It's all safe stuff. They even have caffeine on there, though they say caffeine added, not naturally occurring. So naturally occurring caffeine is okay, but they won't add any extra.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow.
And then they have vanilla, right? Vanilla and synthetic only. So the natural stuff is fine. They have that on a number of things. Anything, if it's naturally occurring, it's okay. But if it's synthetic, then it's poison.
What?
Yeah, so they've gone full food, babe. Very disappointing. Because, yeah, I just don't know how I could go there again.
That's so depressing.
Nope. Yeah.
That's pathetic. Shouldn't they have science advisors like movies?
I think they don't care.
Come on.
Seriously.
Yeah, you would think they're making food, though, for people to eat. Like, that's so scary. They don't have a single scientist helping them with this.
I think there's a disconnect between the marketing, you know, branch and their science department, right? The marketing people don't care.
There's no way they don't have food scientists working.
Yeah, so you're right. Yeah. It's just happening downstream.
Well, are the food scientists in these corporations standing up?
Yeah, but Evan, think about it. I mean, it's like two completely different departments
in
a very big company, you know, and they're sitting there inventing, you know, new recipes and coming up with new food items and then they're like, wow, the marketing team is totally blowing it. What can we do about it? Well, let's talk to upper management. You know, and upper management's like, well, we're making the money. You know what I mean? Like, I know that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, but in essence, those food scientists can't change the company that easily. I'm sure they might. I'm hoping they're saying things, but it's not working, and we know that they're there.
I mean, I would consider walking out. I mean, my company starts doing that I work for. If I'm a food scientist, I'd be like, guys, this is ridiculous. I'm out of here. You know, and try to take as many people with me.
Well, the thing is, we are seeing this disconnect in pharmaceuticals as well, where the marketing people want to promote certain uses that maybe are not completely supported by the studies, and the scientists generally fight quite hard not to have that done, but marketing very often wins.
Yeah, but in pharmaceutical industry, at least here in the United States, the FDA has very strict limits on what the marketing department is allowed to do. They can't freewheel it. They have to strictly follow FDA guidelines, and if they don't, they get fined sometimes billions of dollars. I mean, they could. Mm-hmm. It's big, big, big fines from the FDA. So,
and think about it. Even in such a highly regulated industry, you're still seeing that how they're trying to stretch it to the extent that they can.
They're still pushing the envelope. They're pushing the limits. Absolutely, but there are lines there at least. But yeah, in the food industry, there's nothing similar. There's no strict regulation. Like the package insert is literally what the company can say about a pharmaceutical drug. But there's no equivalent of that, you know, with sandwiches.
there's no sandwich packages.
But anyway,
it's funny.
This is old school, though. This is old school marketing. You fearmonger about your competitor, and you don't have to name your competitor. You just create this vague fear in your target audience that everyone other than us is going to feed you poison, but we're not going to feed you poison, right? So you don't even have to say that other companies are doing. You could just doing it. You just imply it. You say, "We promise we will never have this harmful chemical in our product," right? I didn't say that other people have it in theirs. I'm just implying that it's unsafe and implying that other people have it. You create this vague fear, and then people go, well, just to be sure, I better buy that guy's product. This has been going on as long as I've been alive, right? This is nothing.
Oh, gosh. Edison and Tesla, this happened to, long time ago.
All right. Anyway, let's move on. Evan.
Yeah.
So you're going to tell us about the Chinese radio dish that's the largest radio dish in the world.
It is, in fact, one of the largest. It has a specific type to it, which I'll get to in a second. So just last year, China's massive radio telescope, which is named FAST, began its three-year test run. And this telescope has the distinction of being the world's largest filled aperture radio telescope. Yeah, there's actually one telescope larger in Russia, which won't talk about in this new segment. But so certainly it's second largest, it would appear to be. But this particular type, it is the largest. Now, FAST is an acronym, right, Bob?
Yes.
It stands for 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope. 500 meters in diameter. So I'm going to put that in, I'm going to put that in perspective for you. So that's the surface area of the dish built into a natural basin in the ground, and the surface area of the dish is 48.5 acres.
Whoa.
So think of your neighbor's farm wherever you are.
Wow.
That is
huge.
48.5 acres.
How many
acres.
Hectares is that?
Is it what, there's 2 hectares in an acre? Is that what that is? I don't recall.
Evan, how many quaaludes would it take to buy that?
Oh my gosh.
Jay, I was thinking
the same
thing.
What are you guys saying right now? What are you talking about? Do you mean hectares? What is happening in my brain?
Hectares. How many furlongs is it?
Stop it. It hurts.
All right.
How many fortnights would it take me to walk all the way around it?
They still say Fortnite in England. Do you guys say Fortnite in Australia?
In New England?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
oh,
yeah, Rob, that's a normal thing they do in
fact,
England. So
in fact, my favorite unit of measurement ever is the smoot, which you can look it up online, and you can use smoots in novel ways, such as the speed of light in smoots per fortnight.
Wow.
Oh my
smoots
gosh.
Smoots per Fortnite. That's cool.
Smoots
one
that's
smoot
Fortnite.
Is equal to Oliver Smoot's height at the time of the prank, 5 feet 7 inches. Oh, that's hilarious. This is a non-standard humorous unit of
it's
length.
A, yeah.
A hectare is 2.471 acres, by the way.
Oh, gotcha.
48.5 acres is the size of this dish. Back to FAST. Now, if you want to get an image in your mind what it looks like, the basic design of FAST is similar to the Arecibo Observatory radio telescope. And if you remember, was featured in the movie Contact. I love that movie. The Arecibo Observatory is in the early part of the movie where Dr. Ellie Arroway goes to use it to search for alien life. So very cool. This type of telescope. They are fixed primary reflectors installed in natural hollows, like a basin, made of perforated aluminum panels with a movable receiver suspended above. That's the basic way to describe how it works. And as I mentioned before, it's going to take 3 years to calibrate the various instruments so it can become fully operational. And once it does, it will require hundreds of astronomers to operate it at full functionality. Very cool. A few things that FAST is going to be doing will include pulsar observations, detection of interstellar molecules, studying dark matter, and my favorite, detecting interstellar communication signals. So this thing is amazing. Very cool science. But it's making headlines this particular week because sources close to the project are expressing a concern. Well, as Admiral Akbar once famously said long ago, it's a trap. Yep, it's a tourist trap. And maybe using the word trap is a little too harsh here, but however, it is a not so insignificant reason that this project was undertaken in the first place to generate tourism to this region of China. And they have succeeded in doing so. It has become one of the top tourist destinations for all of China.
What?
And that's, yeah, no, it is. I saw it in the top 5 list for the year, for 2017. Top 5 attractions in China.
That's fantastic. A scientific installation being a top attraction, tourist attraction, sounds pretty awesome to me.
It does. It does sound awesome. But there is a negative component to all of this because the astronomers are concerned too much tourism means too much interference, mostly electromagnetic interference from things like cell phones, Wi-Fi, computers, and a whole host of other sources capable of interfering with the fragile signals that the scientists are trying to collect from outer space. Deep outer space, by the way, as far as 11 billion light years outer space is what we're talking about. So here comes a signal from a proto-galaxy 11 billion light years away, and suddenly, hey, Ma, it's me on FaceTime. I'm up here on the telescope doohickey thing. You can imagine it interfering with the signal like we're in the middle of some important scientific data collection. It would be awful. But actually, most of the tourism is coming from within the country. So people from China are actually flocking to it. That makes up the bulk of the tourists. For example, during the Dragon Boat Festival on May 30th, about 220,000 people crowded at the dish. around the site in the mountains.
Quarter million.
Quarter million people, yeah. And over the course of the year 2017, they estimate 10 million tourists will be drawn to the attraction. Now, a cell phone signal, they say, is a billion times more powerful than the cosmic waves that a telescope like FAST is going to try to detect. And this small town, which was purposefully chosen because of its sort of remote area and, you know, general quietness to it all, they've opened 46 hotels and 100 restaurants to cope with the tourism. So it's becoming...
Wow.
There's a potential for problems here. Now, some scientists are saying that it probably won't be a problem. They can deal with it because it is, of course, pointing straight up into the sky. And the direction of that will not, you know, be directly... won't get direct interference, say, from the Wi-Fi and the cell phones and these sorts of things, but they don't know because this they didn't know that this volume of tourism was actually going to be happening. So they're encouraging more environmental studies or environmental impact studies as to how this is possibly going to affect the readings and things that they're going to be getting. And a lot of scientists are concerned they really want that to happen sooner than later.
Yeah. Evan, do you know if this is different to what's happening with other major radio telescopes around the world?
Well, only in the sense that the amount of tourists that it has attracted seems to be kind of off the charts, and you really doesn't seem to compare to other regions. I mean, they do get tourism, certainly, at some of these other large telescopes or arrays or whatnot, but they have the same sort of volume that they're experiencing with FAST.
I'm wondering whether it could be something to do with the telescope due to its sheer size being more sensitive. Because, for example, Jodrell Bank. There's a very large radio telescope near Manchester in the UK. I don't think they even have signs there or anything that says no mobile phones. I think they don't allow mobile phones out in the field in front of the telescope or near the telescope. In Tidbinbilla, near Canberra in Australia, there's a major radio telescope installation.
What is the word you just said?
Canberra?
It's the name of the place, Tidbinbilla.
Tidbinbilla?
Yeah, that's the name of
that.
Yeah, so they were part of the... they're part of NASA's deep space network. In fact, I was there a few years ago as it was uploading instructions to Spirit on Mars.
Cool.
It was really low on the horizon. It was sending instructions to Spirit. So, and there, it's in a valley surrounded by mountains. So it's kind of isolated from the environment.
Right.
And for probably about something like 15, 20 kilometers before you get to Tidbinbilla, there's signs, very big signs, every few hundred meters saying, switch off your mobile phones, don't kill our research.
Now, what's interesting, so these really, really large dishes are basically built into the ground, and so they're fixed. You can't move them like a dish on a tower, you know, that you could move around.
You can't, but they do move the internal portions of
the receiver, yeah.
The receiver itself can move, and the plates that they create in the dish, part of it, towards the center, are able to be somewhat tilted in certain directions to help. Gain the proper direction that they want to pick up.
Yeah, that's true of the FAST one, but not Arecibo. So Arecibo is a spherical reflector that's fixed, and because it's spherical, it could focus in many different locations, and so they just move the receiver around to where they want to focus. The mm-hmm. FAST one apparently can change the shape of it so that to change where it focuses as well as moving the receiver.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so it's a more updated, I guess, than the older Arecibo one.
Right. The money the tourism is bringing into this area of China is not insignificant.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly enough to pay for a lot of these things and try to, you know, do things like hire better astronomers to come in.
They should make like a tourism day. Like, all right, Mondays, the scientists are off. Tourists can come, you know, stomp around with their cell phones and their selfies. And, you know, but then Tuesday through Sunday, no tourists. They ought to do something like that.
Yeah. Some compromise is going to have to be reached to you know, because what the hell? Why have the thing if it's not going to work correctly? you want. Right, I mean, it's great that people are interested, but at the same time, the science has to get done.
Absolutely. All right, Bob, when you sent me your news item, Bob said, cyborg bacteria. Need I say more? Kind of up your alley. What's going on?
Yeah, it's I saw those two words in when I was scanning news items. I'm like, yeah, cyborg bacteria. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. It almost doesn't even matter what it's about. I'm going to have to cover it just for that title. So chemists have created a hybrid organism. It's a hybrid using bacteria and
that's my line, Steve.
You relate to you're slow.
Too much of that Kentucky bluegrass.
So it's a hybrid using bacteria and non-organic crystal solar collectors on its surface. And if that wasn't enough, these nano collectors are more efficient light harvesters than plant photosynthesis and can be used to convert CO2 into a host of valuable chemicals. How crazy awesome is that? These little bits of awesomeness were created by chemists Pidong Yang and Kelsey Sakamoto, who presented their work recently at the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society. Did you know that the American Chemical Society is the world's largest scientific society? It is.
I do now.
I didn't know that.
Yes, according to my sources, it is. So now it's a no-brainer to some people anyway that we need to move away from fossil fuels for both the production of energy sources and as a kind of feedstock for the creation of these important chemicals. And to that end, artificial photosynthesis has been attempted for years to achieve this. Never quite, you know, still working on it, still got a ways to go. And this one looks more promising than most anything else I've seen in the realm of biofuels anyway. Very fascinating stuff. Pidong Yang said, the thrust of research in my lab is to essentially supercharge non-photosynthetic bacteria by providing them energy in the form of electrons from inorganic semiconductors like cadmium sulfide that are efficient light absorbers. So to achieve this end, they start by feeding these non-photosynthetic bacterium, and they're called Morella thermoacetica. They feed these bacteria certain compounds that actually allow it to synthesize cadmium sulfide nanoparticles into these semiconductor nanocrystals around the entire microorganism. So basically what all that mumbo jumbo means is that each bacteria is essentially covering itself with nano solar panels and then using that energy. That's what they're doing. But that's not even the really awesome news. The really awesome news is that, first off, that this process is being described as self-replicating and self-regenerating and a zero-waste technology. So that's one. I mean, once you set this up, it pretty much, you know, these solar collectors are pretty much continue to be created for all the replicating bacteria. And but even more impressive, the energy efficiency is a whopping 80%. Now, Steve, I found some discrepancy in terms of how much of an improvement. 80% is damn high, but one source was telling me that's four times more efficient. But your article was saying that photosynthesis using chlorophyll is basically only, what, 3-6% efficient?
Yeah, that was a reference I found, 3-6% okay. efficient. But I could double check it while you're talking.
Yeah, but it's still many times more efficient than anything we've seen in terms of things that are found in nature. So just with a little sunlight and water, what happens is that these bacteria basically breathe in carbon dioxide and exhale acetic acid. That's essentially what's going on. So this is a hybrid organism, and they're calling it Morella thermoacetica CDS for cadmium sulfide. But personally, I think they should call it Morella thermoacetica cyborgus. Come on, it just rolls off the tongue. It just rolls off the tongue a lot more easily.
Good point, Bob.
So now acetic acid, you might be thinking, well, what the hell is that? It's a wonderful chemical. It's kind of like this foundational chemical you could use to upgrade into any number of amazing compounds like fuels, pharmaceuticals, polymers, other kind of commodity chemicals. And all of this from sunlight. And but also through the use of these complementary genetically engineered bacteria, you would still need these other bacteria to bootstrap that acetic acid into these other more valuable compounds. But it's still, you know, it's still using a renewable resource that pretty much is running mostly on sunlight. So in the future, we're going to now, they're going to look for some more benign light absorbers, more benign than cadmium sulfide, to provide the bacteria with energy from light. The cadmium sulfide can cause some downstream, products that you might not want, some toxicity levels and things like that, I think. But other questions, though, are important to think about, though. You know, can this be scaled up and industrialized, as Steve said in his blog post? That's huge. And often you see small scale miracles that just won't scale up. And that's it. You're done. You know, if you can't scale this kind of thing up, it just makes it so much more limited. And then there's other problems like the attenuation of light. So you can't have these deep, deep vats because the light's just not going to get all the way down there. So you're going to need these really big, shallower vats. And, you know, how is that going to affect, you know, scaling this thing up? Distillation may require a lot of energy. You know, you're not going to turn on a spigot and have this acetic acid come out that you could then manipulate into other compounds. You know, you're going to have to get that stuff out of there. You know, what kind of problems and inefficiencies and expenses are that going to introduce? You know, we're still not sure, precisely what that's going to be. So this is something that does look amazing. And I think just generally speaking, this whole idea of taking bacteria that have evolved, you know, over millions and billions of years, you know, and some bacteria, remember, these were the first life forms. You know, extremophiles are called extremophiles for, you know, a very good reason. They are extreme. They do extremely crazy things with their metabolisms that no other organisms can do.
By the way, I was double checking, you know, there were several sources say, yeah, 3-6% is the efficiency of photosynthesis. Okay. I actually found a paper that calculated the maximum efficiency of photosynthesis
under optimal
conditions. They estimated to be 8-9%. That's like
with chlorophyll, you mean?
It just says, well, photosynthesis. I just think using a photo system to, you know, reduce CO2 and use oxygen to produce oxygen, you know. They said that
right. Thermodynamically
has a maximum efficiency of 8-9%.
Oh, there you go. So for what they're, you know, specifically doing, they're much more close to a maximum than you would think.
Yeah, right.
All right. I feel better about nature.
I'm not a big fan of biofuels because we don't have the land. You know, I just think that's a bad plan to use land to grow fuel when, you know, we're already pretty much at our maximal land use. But having vats of bacteria, yeah, that might be viable. It all depends on how this scales up. If it's of anything other than just a niche, you know, curiosity.
Right.
One cool thing is that you could turn acetic acid into butanol, and you could burn butanol in like gasoline without even modifying the engine. Yeah. So anyway, interesting. And we know that most of the stuff we talk about never going to come into existence.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Just because there's so many competing possibilities, but it is interesting that this kind of thing is possible. You know, we're engineering bacteria to grow solar cells on their outer surface. Cool. All right. Hey, Ron, you're going to talk to us about a very interesting item on the outcome of children raised by same-sex couples, which apparently is a controversial topic.
Well, it's not directly the topic. It's just something that's being used politically. Currently, Australia's legal definition of marriage limits it to one man and one woman. It is not, as many people think, a traditional or long-standing legal definition. It's something that only changed in 2004.
Wow.
Over the years, there has been an increasing pressure on governments to allow same-sex couples to marry, with surveys in Australia showing approximately 70% of the population supports marriage equality, as does a majority in every single age group, although obviously, as expected, older voters were less in favour than younger voters. The only groups that consistently have a majority against marriage equality are older voters of conservative parties and those with strong religious views. And of course, there's an overlap between these groups. Unfortunately, due to just the political circumstances haven't been favorable, and politicians have not been on the same page with public opinion. I don't want to go too much into the politics of it because it's not particularly interesting to anybody outside of Australia. However, it's now likely that there will be a plebiscite about whether to change the law and allow same-sex couples to marry. And while it's not strictly speaking a vote, both sides of the debate want to get their message across and convince as many people as possible. Unsurprisingly, religious organizations have been at the forefront of objecting to same-sex marriage for years, and they're leading the charge now too. Many of their arguments are moral in nature, and we really can't, we can argue with them, but not on a scientific basis. But since they also want to appeal to those who are not swayed by religious arguments, they put a lot of focus on outcomes for children with same-sex parents, because that obviously everybody wants to protect children. That's got nothing to do with what your views are.
Think
you will always want
children.
To protect children. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And sometimes they try to present scientific research that supports their position. One such example is a 2015 paper titled Emotional Problems Among Children with Same-Sex Parents. The lead author of that paper is a professor at the Australian Catholic University. His name is Paul Sullins. Professor Sullins is a Catholic priest who has written papers along the same lines in the past. A particularly nasty poster that is titled Stop the Fags cites some statistics from this study as its arguments. They say 92% of children raised by gay parents are abused, 51% have depression, and 72% are obese. I think these numbers sound unlikely on the face of it. However, let's look at it from a purely scientific perspective. There is a problem. This paper was published in an Egyptian open access journal that has been criticized in the past for its lax peer review. And by saying lax, I'm probably being a little bit charitable based on what I've seen. When the paper was actually reviewed by academics in social sciences, they found major problems both with the methodology of the paper and the way conclusions were derived from the data. This paper is probably, and this poster, are probably one of the most egregious examples of using bad science in support of a position in this debate, but it's not the only one, and unfortunately it's probably not the last one. The reality is that there does not appear to be any scientific evidence that children of same-sex parents fare less well than children in other family circumstances, but that doesn't stop campaigners from using scientifically sounding arguments to promote their view. And just to be fair, I want to point out that it is not limited to the no side, the use of unscientific arguments. But of course, this is a particularly egregious example. This problem is not specific to marriage equality. It's not specific to Australia right now. And of course, we've seen it before, using science, bad science, in a political campaign, and the devastating results that can result are something that we've seen before, for example, with climate change. We know that very often changing the status quo is quite difficult, and all that's required from those who want to keep the status quo is to sow just enough doubt, just enough fear amongst the population to make sure that people don't want things to change. They don't have to convincing for a change is much harder and requires a much more profound approach. At Australian Skeptics, we are now working on a paper that will summarize the claims on both sides and assess the evidence for and against those claims. And we can only hope that the public will not be swayed by the bad science in the same way that it had in past debates.
Yeah, so I do think this is one of those situations where the science itself is actually not controversial, right?
No.
Yeah, so I mean, I did a little background research on it myself, and you know, the multiple recent systematic reviews basically see, yeah, there's been 30 years of research into this topic, and there's an overwhelming consensus that the kids raised in same-sex couples are just fine, that there's no adverse outcome.
No, in fact, any differences are very small, but any differences generally tend to be in favor of children of
same-sex
parents.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. Yeah, but, you know, again, the problem is that the status quo is that same-sex marriage is not allowed, and change is always hard. So it's enough to sow a bit of doubt. You use bad signs, some nasty headlines, and that can have an effect.
But it's very easy to cherry pick the science that you want, you know, even if it's published in a crappy, you know, pay-for-play, you know, Egyptian journal conducted by a Catholic priest.
Yeah, I actually found, you know, that poster, it said 51% of children of same-sex couples have depression. I was saying, do you think your headline, you know, might have something to do with it?
Well, they didn't say what the percentage of children in different sex couples have depression by the same measure, right? So just saying that doesn't even say anything. What's the background rate, you know?
Compared to what?
Yeah. So without saying that, that's like inherently deceptive.
Yeah. You said that thing about like a certain percentage have obesity. And I was like, a lot of kids are obese. Like that's a epidemic, regardless of who your parents are.
No, I think we can even, let's assume that we agree that these numbers are high, that 92%.
Yeah.
Regardless of what the paper says, 92% abused, that's very high. 51% have depression, that's high. 72% obese, yeah, that's high.
Is that high?
Even if we accept
it
all
is,
of
it
the,
is high.
It is, okay. All
even
right.
if we accept, States. But even if we accept that, it's poor science, it's out of context. There's so many reasons why these numbers are...
Yeah, but that's just part of it. They're not putting it into any kind of context. It's just a big, scary number.
Yeah.
Basically. All right, thanks, Haran. Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses?
That's that creature that came from outer space that wanted to talk to the humpback whales in Star Trek 12 or whatever it was.
Yeah. I think that was Star Trek 4?
4, yes, it was.
I actually thought
there'd be
was
whales
a,
here.
Yeah, I thought it was a baby whale that's mistaking a submarine for its mom.
Okay. This this was sent in by a listener named Frederick Cassette last week, and or Cosette. All right, so we did have a lot of people email in some guesses, and one of them was a flute in a cave. And I'm like, after re-listening to it with that in mind, I'm like, yeah, that's an interesting guess. It's not that bad of a guess. At first, I'm like, a flute? And I'm like, no, it does kind of sound like someone like trilling on a flute a little bit, but that is not correct. And then somebody else thought it was a didgeridoo, which I thought was interesting.
I object.
Yes, but anyone that has really heard a didgeridoo or played one, I'm a huge fan of the didgeridoo. I have one. Steve has one. We play them. That's not a didgeridoo. But I did get a very, very good explanation from a listener who guessed correctly, and that was John Setterfield. And John said, he said this is called the apprehension engine. Anybody hear of this?
No. Nope. Yeah.
No.
Okay, well, the winner actually for this week was Jerry Gulhirme. My God, I'm sorry I pronounced that wrong. But he just wrote in a couple of details, so I will list what the other person actually wrote. This is the apprehension engine, an instrument used to create musical scores for horror movies.
Whoa.
And the reason why I thought I would mention this particular listener is John said that his brother-in-law or his wife's brother-in-law is the guy who invented it.
Oh, so, cool.
So he was okay with being automatically disqualified because it's almost a family member. this thing is really cool, guys. So this was invented by a music composer named Mark Corvin, and he wanted to make an instrument that can sound or make sounds that are fitting for horror movies. And then he noticed that nothing existed to really get the feel that he wanted. So he thought maybe he can get involved with making it himself, and he ended up working with a guitar maker named Tony Dugan Smith, and together they came up with the apprehension engine. So it has several bowed metal rulers, spring reverbs, and several long metal rods, and other sorts of attachments. And then when they're properly played, they can make these incredibly fantastic sounds that set an intensely creepy mood. And you know, if you listen to it, and I just played a very brief segment of all these different kinds of sounds that this thing could make. You know, they have to properly reverb it, of course, and everything to really give it some depth and some atmosphere. But it does, indeed, this thing makes really scary, creepy, like something, you know, around the corner, monster in the basement type sounds. I love it. So, Bob, I thought, you know, Halloween is coming. It's never too early to give an early shout out to Halloween. I'd be interested for you to listen to the, like a YouTube video of this and tell me what you think about it.
Sure, man. Absolutely.
So good job, Jerry. That I don't. Not many people wrote in guessing it, so I don't think that many people know specifically what it is. So excellent job. Okay, I have a new noisy for you guys this week. This noisy was sent in by Steve Harris. Steve, you know Steve, right?
I do know Steve.
Steve's a longtime listener and supporter of the show, and he thought, hey, let me send in something. Now, this is, he didn't exactly say this, but he's saying, in essence, a lot of people that listen to the show should know what this is, and you may recognize aspects of this, but I want, as usual, very specific answers to what we're listening to. So when responding to this noisy, give me a very, very specific answer to what it is. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org with any cool noises you heard this week and the answer to this week's sound.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week is a fun one. It's really a holdover from last week.
Oh, Kara, you did it.
What?
A listener wrote in and said, every week Kara says this one is fun. The week that he wrote in, you didn't do it for the first time.
Are you serious?
And yeah, I'm like,
I never saw that email.
Good coordination,
so
Kara.
Funny.
Yeah, oh so then gosh. I'm like, she doesn't say it all the time, huh?
Yeah, but guys, this one actually is really fun. It's fun to write, it's fun to say, and the Perimeter Institute even posted a meme about it during Eclipse Week about how it's like a great Scrabble word, but the only way you can use it is if the extra Y is a blank. Can you guys guess which word I'm talking about?
Syzygy.
Yes, there you go. Syzygy. It's such a fun word, guys. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. So syzygy is actually the term that's used. And I didn't include this in my list of Eclipse terms last week. What was I thinking? This is the term for when three celestial bodies line up. So three or more, yeah, but that would be probably even more rare. But let me look at the specific definitions from Oxford and from Merriam-Webster, both of which are talking about astronomy definitions. Oxford says a conjunction or opposition, especially of the moon and the sun. So they're kind of just saying two, but I think they mean in relation to the Earth and just sort of left that out of the definition. And Merriam-Webster says the nearly straight line configuration of three celestial bodies, such as the sun, moon, and Earth during a solar or lunar eclipse in a gravitational system. Interestingly, Oxford also has a second definition, which is just a pair of connected or corresponding things. I'm assuming that's a little bit more of a poetic definition or a literary definition, because I could definitely see somebody saying that, you know, all of these events were aligned in syzygy, and that means that, you know, everything worked out just in a perfect line or something. But when you look at the etymology of the term, it is a Latin term from the 1650s, or it actually goes back later in late Latin, but that Latin is adapted from Greek, which is pretty common. From the Greek, I'm not going to pronounce this right, but syzygia, which actually means a yoke of animals, a pair, a conjunction, or even a union of two. Syzygian, or syzygyne, or gyne, I'm not sure, can actually be broken down, which meant to yoke together. It was a verb, can be broken down into cis, which is an adaptation of the prefix syn, which means, you know, together, like synthesize, and zygon, which means yoke. So really, this word evolved out of the idea of yoking things together. You guys know what like yoked cattle or something like that. So yoking things together. And if you think about it, it just extends to this idea of these heavenly bodies, in essence, kind of in a more metaphorical sense, being yoked together and causing this alignment. And of course, we wouldn't have an eclipse without syzygy. Syzygy is the point of the eclipse. It is aligned such that the sun, which is 400 times larger than the Earth, is behind the moon, which is 400 times closer. So they look like they're the same size from the Earth. It's that perfect line phenomenon.
Kara, you know when I first learned the word syzygy?
When?
In 1982, right, Bob?
Yep.
And why is that, Steve?
So that was after the eclipse in 79. So why was it?
No.
Because in March 10th of 1982, all of the planets in our solar system were within about a 30-degree arc on one side of the sun.
Yeah.
No, they weren't. That's crazy.
Yeah. And the world didn't end?
And the world didn't end. But of course, there was all kinds of rumors. This is pre-internet, so they weren't on the internet, but it was still...
They were like, in
there,
books.
There's going to be earthquakes, and the earth is going to end. But no, like the gravitational effect of the other planets is negligible compared to the sun.
Well, yeah, and we saw that a lot during the eclipse. I thought it was really funny. A lot of the questions, and you know, there were some naive questions that were sent in, which were smart and interesting, like, does this affect the tides? Does it? But when you really think about it, like, a lot of people were saying, oh, this thing's going to happen, like you said, an earthquake, or there's going to be tidal waves. And it's like, no, the sun is where the sun is always. The moon is where the moon is generally. They just happen to be lined up. Like, nothing is different.
The tides were higher. Because they
How
were,
much higher?
They were sure. perfectly, they could be, they were significantly higher in some locations. It depends.
Really?
Yeah, because they're perfectly lined up, they're the tidal
And the
effects,
gravitational effect of the
like
sun.
Constructive interference.
Pulls it even more. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, without the moon, we'd still have tides and they'd be greatly attenuated, but they'd be solar tides.
But the moon and the sun are very closely aligned from a tide perspective.
All the time?
Every new moon.
Every new moon.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Every
okay.
new moon.
Right.
That's
okay.
great. This was just slightly more in line, so that gave bigger tides. The effect could seem out of proportion, even though they're only slightly more in alignment just because of the way tides work. It actually is measurable in terms of the peak.
Oh,
you know,
I didn't realize. I figured it would be negligible. That's interesting.
Yeah, so that's when we learned that word, syzygy, 1982.
Yeah.
How fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
I'm glad you didn't use that for science fiction, Steve. I'd have got that wrong.
All right, guys. One email. I couldn't resist this one.
Okay.
The question comes from Conrad from Fargo, don't you know?
That's why you couldn't resist it.
Fargo, North Dakota. And Conrad writes, clearly farting makes you have less mass, but does it make you weigh more or less? Figure this would be a good question for the show since farts are always funny. Always. So... That's the question. I put that to the panel. If you fart, do you lose weight because you have expelled mass, or do you gain weight because you have lost the buoyancy of the gas inside of you? What do you think?
Oh, my God.
I don't know how much methane weighs.
So
methane still doesn't weigh negative weight.
Well, but it could be buoyant in air. That's the thing, right?
Buoyant in air. Oh, yeah, because we're not talking about mass.
Now, in a vacuum, it wouldn't matter. You would lose
exactly.
weight, right? If you were in a vacuum, you'd lose because there's no buoyancy.
You'd lose mass. Yeah.
You'd lose weight as well. If you were in a vacuum chamber on Earth and you farted, you would lose weight because there's no buoyancy.
That's true. There is still weight because of gravity.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in let's say at sea level, you know, one atmosphere of pressure, and you let out a good toot. Did you? I mean, it's probably going to not be that much, but theoretically, would you have gained or lost weight? What do you guys? What's your vote?
Lost. I think you lose weight. I mean, with the volume of farts that I have, it's got to be a weight loss.
No, it would have to be a gain.
I would think gain.
Well, it is a gain to the surrounding area.
I don't think it has to be. In my mind, it doesn't have to be anything because you're expelling so little mass, but you're also losing so little buoyancy that it's like at that level,
Bob,
it can go either way.
It's saying it's negligible, but which way does it go, though?
Yeah, so if you are on the most sensitive scale,
is methane,
oh, Bob.
You can't suss it out. I can't suss it out.
You can
suss
on
it
a
out. Go ahead.
Super?
You absolutely can.
Can you give us some indication as to whether methane is lighter than air?
Okay, so... You've hit upon one question that gets to the answer, and that is the density, right, of the various gases that make up flatulence compared to the density of air.
Air is mostly nitrogen.
I've only heard methane mentioned, but methane is not necessarily the only component of flatulence.
That's true.
What do you think flatulence is made out of?
Well, I thought it was mostly methane.
If there's methane, is there like CO2 in it?
There's CO2.
Is there nitrogen?
There's nitrogen.
Ooh, I'm good
is
at this.
Is there a little oxygen?
Is there helium?
There's no helium.
I wouldn't think so.
How about a little oxygen,
crap particles.
I wonder what a helium fart would sound like.
It would be adorable.
I need to know.
That needs to be a Who's That Noisy is a helium fart. Okay, yeah. So we said there's oxygen, there's CO2, there's nitrogen, and there's methane.
Well, we didn't get an okay on oxygen.
Oh, is there oxygen?
No, there's negligible oxygen. Yeah.
Okay,
negligible.
CO2, nitrogen, methane, and I assume we're still waiting on something. So give us a hint.
So it's clearly variable based upon
diet,
what you've eaten, you know,
and your gut bacteria
and how much air you've swallowed. So mm-hmm. nitrogen is the main component. It's like 20% to 90%. So there's a huge variability there depending on how much gas produced by bacteria versus gas you've swallowed. Then methane, you've hit upon hydrogen. Hydrogen gas is made by some bacteria.
Hydrogen.
Nitrogen, there is some oxygen. Again, based on if you're swallowing air and it's mainly swallowed air, there will be some oxygen, but that oxygen has probably largely been metabolized too, so that's a small component. Carbon dioxide could be as high as 20% carbon dioxide.
Hydrogen sulfide.
So, and then there's a lot of other things that add to the smell, but don't necessarily contribute a significant amount to the volume. So by volume, it's nitrogen, carbon dioxide, methane, hydrogen, and maybe a tiny bit of oxygen.
So in that case, it's heavier. In that case, that would be heavier than air, because if it's mostly nitrogen, like air, and carbon dioxide is a significant component, basically roughly equivalent to the oxygen that we have in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And carbon dioxide is heavier than oxygen.
That's correct.
Then it would be heavier. Then the fart would be heavier than air.
Yeah. So Iran is correct. It's heavier than air. Because it's because of the carbon dioxide, because it's mostly nitrogen and carbon dioxide, and that's nitrogen is again the same as air, and carbon dioxide is significantly heavier than oxygen. Hydrogen and methane are the ones that are lighter than air, but you have them like 10 to 20%, you know, so it's not enough to make it lighter than air. There's one other factor though. So there's what it's made of, what's the density of the gases, and the third one is what's the pressure that the gases are under. And I couldn't find the answer to that question. What is the air pressure inside your colon, basically? So, but I imagine it's higher than one atmosphere, but not that high, would be my guess. But it probably adds a little bit to the overall density as well, right? You could think about it this way. How explosive are your farts?
I love this conversation.
Yeah.
Right? The more explosive they are, the higher pressure they were under before they came out.
But I also love that we're like on this science show talking about all of these nerdy scientific components, yet we're still calling them farts.
Or flatulence. Actually, the fart is sort of is the sound. The flatulence is the gas.
Ah.
Really?
It's flat. It's like flatus. Isn't that how they use it?
When flatus. So gross. Yeah.
Flatus.
Flatus.
With the flatus.
lady with the flatus.
So at least, see, there's one thing. One thing has clearly been achieved by this discussion right now is we got to talk about farts. That's as the listeners said, it's always funny.
As they intended, obviously. And so the other bottom line is that when you fart, you lose a little weight. So
I love that.
Toot it up if you're trying to lose weight. Yeah.
Toot it up.
All right. Well, thanks, Conrad. Well, a couple of announcements before we go on to science or fiction. So next weekend, we're going to be at Dragon Con.
Yeah, baby.
We are going to do a live show from the stage on Sunday at 4 p.m. But also, we're going to do a private recording. These are always fun. They always sell out. We've sold out every one that we've done. A private recording, basically $75 per person. You get to join us in a small group while we record a show. It's very interactive, a lot of fun. That's going to be Saturday night, 10 p.m. The location is to be determined. We have to basically find out where we could set up when we get there. So if you're going to Dragon Con next weekend, just and you want to go to the private recording, email us. Contact us. We will tell you how to send us the money. You can, of course, you could pay for it on site. Once we're there and we have the location, just we'll email us again. We'll tell everybody we have on our list where the location is. It'll be a super secret, so only us will be there. Again, that will be Saturday night at 10 p.m. We usually have a special guest, which we will sort out once we get there. So, but it'll be the whole SGU crew plus probably an additional person. Again, these are always tons of fun. And Iran, you have a couple of things coming up as well.
Yeah, so there is the European Skeptics Congress on the 23rd and 24th of September in Wrocław, in the southern part of Poland. And there will be many great speakers. I'll be speaking as well. So great speakers and me. We also have our own Australian Skeptics National Convention, which happens every year. This year will be the 33rd consecutive one. I believe we are by far the oldest skeptical convention in the world now. And that's happening on the weekend of 18th and 19th of November in Sydney. And Kara, you'll be there.
I will. Yeah, I'll be there. I'm so excited.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having you there. And there will be many other great speakers. You can look online. It's dubbed Skepticon 2017. You can look it up and find more information about it.
Also, one last thing. Our next live streaming event is happening on Sunday, September 17th at noon Eastern Time. We will be live in our studio with a video streaming event. The content is to be determined. We'll be joined on that event by George Hrob. So mark your calendar, September 17th, Sunday, 12 noon Eastern Time on our Facebook page.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But this week, they're all fake.
What?
Yes, that's correct.
Him?
The theme this week is internet hoaxes. So two of these are actual hoaxes, and one of them I made up.
Oh, no.
So one is a fake fake. The other two are real fakes. So you have to tell me which one I made up, because the other two were actually spread online as if they were real. Got it?
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. NASA is predicting that in November, there will be 15 days of complete darkness. Item number two, the LA Police Department plans to spend $1 billion on jetpacks for their officers. And item number three, a killer goose the size of an ostrich menaced visitors to Isle Royale National Park in Michigan, killing three people and has yet to be captured. Okay, Iran is our guest. You get to go first.
Yeah, I noticed that Bob always feels free to make noises when there's guests because he knows he won't be first.
Right.
That's true.
Oh, and Kara just always forgets.
Very good.
Yeah, always.
So, first one, NASA is predicting that in November there will be 15 days of complete darkness. This sounds like the kind of thing that absolutely nobody would fall for. So it's probably a real hoax. The reality is that there's enough people in the world who will just fall for anything. So people might try something outrageous. The LA Police Department plans to spend $1 billion on jetpacks for their officers. That sounds like something that somebody would want to freak people out. In terms of your tax dollars at work kind of thing. That actually sounds like a plausible kind of hoax. Plausible in the sense of that somebody would try to do this. And a killer goose the size of an ostrich menaced visitors to Isle Royale National Park in Michigan, killing three people and yet to be captured. Oof. Look, my tendency is to think that the first one is just too far-fetched to be a real hoax that somebody would try to perpetuate on the internet. However, why would you put something so obvious there? I'm going to just have to guess. My inclination, just looking at it logically, it would probably be number one. However, we're talking about hoaxes. I would say that the second one you made up.
The LA Police Department
plans to spend $1 billion on jetpacks.
That's the fake fake.
Fake fake.
All right, Kara.
NASA's predicting that in November there will be 15 days of complete darkness. Makes no sense. The LA Police Department plans to spend $1 billion on jetpacks for their officers. That's ridiculous. Killer goose the size of an ostrich menaced visitors to Isle Royale National Park in Michigan, killing three people and has yet to be captured. Ludicrous. They could all be hoaxes. That one's super weirdly specific compared to the rest of them. Maybe that is telling me something. Maybe it is not. I think the fun thing to do, guys, is to all pick something different. So I'm going to go with the killer goose because that one is like, I don't know, it just makes me happy.
Okay. As for the fake fake.
As the fake fake.
Okay, Evan?
I have a feeling that the goose one is genuine, is science in this case. Killing three people, that might throw you off, but, you know, hey, animals kill people all the time in weird ways. So I'm not surprised. It's between NASA and the 15 days of complete darkness or the $1 billion jetpacks. It's probably the jetpacks one that is the fake. Two reasons. Number one, people are generally, I think, overall kind of bad at science, so they're more likely to fall for a 15 days of complete darkness kind of thing, not understanding how things really work. Whereas $1 billion on jetpacks, you know, $1 billion, that's a lot of money for a local police department to do anything, Steve. I think you made that one up.
Okay, Bob.
And yet, these same people are willing to go and be okay with a killer goose the size of an ostrich. Something that $1 billion exists. That doesn't exist.
Yeah, do you know how big an ostrich is?
People
will
believe any shit.
What size is a baby ostrich, Bob, people? Thank you. Next case.
Bob, do you have evidence that he doesn't exist?
Yeah, right, the black goose, right?
Well, let's all remember here what we're talking about.
That's a black swan.
We're talking about made up things. So whether Steve made it up or someone else made it up, it's a little hard to discern.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to go with your gut on this one. So I'm going to say...
But two of these, I'm saying, it's not just that somebody made them up. They were spreading on the internet, right? They were spreading.
Exactly. They were trending somewhere.
Somewhere.
Right. So, right. Exactly. They've got to have spreadability. You know what I mean? There's got to be a little bit of spreadability in there. So the NASA one, I think, is spreadable because, you know, it's astronomy.
Like butter.
Weird shit can happen. the police department, yeah, those damn liberal police spending $1 billion on something silly like jetpacks. I could see them. People believe in that. People, you know, they kind of just like kind of gloss over the $1 billion. And here's a police department doing some crazy shit. But a killer goose, the size of an ostrich, I mean, I don't think that has legs, so to speak. But hey, I'm just riffing here because people will believe any – come on, look what we do for a hobby, guys. Any of these could
nothing
be
surprising
could go
anymore.
Either way. But I'll want to go with Karen and say that the ostrich one is the fake fake.
Mm-hmm. And Jay.
All right, Bob, first of all, this is not a hobby. It's a lifestyle choice.
I actually think
I was born this way.
What was that, Ron?
I was going to say exactly the same thing.
Waiting for that.
Okay.
Yeah. We all thought it.
It's environmental.
All right, so I'm kind of agreeing here with what everybody's saying because all this is just utter BS. But 15 days of complete darkness, yes, I would believe that because – you know, the eclipse and everything and people, you know, darkness is on everyone's minds. And, you know, I could see this being something that people on Facebook would kind of like scroll through and think is interesting, but not really go, how, what, you know, what's happening, you know? So, okay, that one is, what would you call something that is not true, Steve, but believable? And I don't want to use the word cromulent. Do we have another word?
Plausible?
Nope, it's cromulent. Oh,
spreadable. Plausible. Go with what I said. Spreadable.
All right, that's spreadable. Thank you, Bob.
Like butter.
That's unspreadable.
Unspreadable. This one, now this is where I have to pull the I'm Steve's brother card and say, I don't think Steve would come up with $1 billion being spent on jetpacks by the LA Police Department. I just don't see him making that up.
But he would make up the ostrich goose.
Yes, that's Bob, that's what I'm saying. But that third one, man, the killer goose one, that sounds like Steve Novella. I got to go with the killer goose. That just got that stinks of Steve Novella. That
stinks okay. of Steve.
So nobody picked NASA. All right, let's start with that one then. NASA is predicting that in November there will be 15 days of complete darkness. You guys all think this one is a real internet hoax, and this one is science in that it's fake.
Yeah. That fake. That pissed me off. I read two articles on that, and I was cursing.
It was, when was it? Is it now?
It was beyond, beyond the beyond. It was like, are you serious? Let me explain to you the logic behind this. It was just like, it was ridiculous. First off, Venus and Jupiter are going to have a close approach, which I calculated to be a half a billion miles. That's like a close approach between Venus and Jupiter. Because remember, it goes Mercury, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter. So Venus is, you know, not the next door to Jupiter. So it's really far away. But then the article kind of mixed that up with a visual separation, you know, in the sky, which of course is completely meaningless, because they're close in the sky doesn't mean they're close in space. So they kind of mix that up. So for some reason, the light of Venus, which is going to be so hot on Jupiter, it's going to cause Jupiter to erupt hydrogen, okay? Hydrogen that will then somehow make its way to the sun, which will then cause the sun to explode when it hits its surface. A part of the sun will kind of like explode away, which will change our sun into like a it will change the color of our sun, making it kind of bluish, which is
so
ridiculous.
Mad.
It was just all gobbledygook.
It was something that made that it broke laws of physics, it broke laws of logic, it broke laws of observation. It was just like on so many levels, you know, just not even close. And I can't believe it. This is like I've come across this multiple times. Like, come on, this is just too stupid.
This originated in 2015. This isn't the first time this is coming around even. I remember this from a couple of years ago.
Really? I don't remember it, but yeah. I was like, oh my God.
But remember, guys, remember that every now and then the rumor spreads around that on Mars's close approach, it's going to look as big in our sky as the moon.
Right.
Yeah. That's how astronomically illiterate people are.
That would be amazing.
And it usually happens. And the funny thing is that it usually happens around the middle of August, because in 2003, around the middle of August, Mars was indeed very close, and that's when it came out. That's when the email was spreading, and every year, like clockwork, comes out, even though it's got nothing to do with Mars' current location.
Yeah. All right. That was a fun one. Let's go to number two. The LA Police Department plans to spend $1 billion on jetpacks for their officers. So Evan and Iran, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Yes.
Guess who reported this as real?
Drudge.
Breitbart.
Fox
News.
Close
enough.
Yeah. Because it fits their narrative.
Yeah,
but they did retract it like an hour later. It took them an hour to figure out. I mean, I'm sure they got tons of phone calls and said, no, this is a total internet hoax. They were hoaxed by...
They didn't even lie and say they were hacked?
No. Weekly World News, which...
Oh, my gosh. Forget it.
Yeah, so
as opposed to the usual source of the National Enquirer,
right? Exactly. which is only a semi joke because the National Enquirer is owned by a right wing, you know, guy who, you know, supports Trump and is right there with Fox News. You know, they actually are on the same side of things. But anyway, so that was tabloid. This is not really tabloid news that then became viral, and. Partly because of Fox News and because it fits a narrative. Like, police department wasting money on this harebrained scheme to have their officers flying around on jetpacks. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Would be cool, though.
So all of that means that a killer goose the size of an ostrich menaced visitors to Isle Royale National Park in Michigan, killing three people and has yet to be captured, is a fake, which I made up out of whole cloth. I didn't base it on anything. I just made it up.
I love it.
Yeah. So,
how the hell do you know Isle Royale National Park in Michigan?
I have to look up a plausible sounding national park. So I just looked up national parks. Like, that's a good remote island in Michigan that nobody goes to. You know, that'll be good. That's perfect. So I just use that one.
Steve Novella instincts have been.
Yeah. You got to totally play the brother card on that one, Jay.
Well, I mean,
hey, if you got to do it, you got to.
They've had you all over it, Steve. It had a bird in it.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm afraid, something crypto's
hey Jay, that's a good point.
The thing is that one is humorous. Like, there is a joke in there. It's not like, you know, $1 billion on jetpacks, which is like sci-fi cool. That one is literally
that's humorous too.
Could you just picture the scene that Steve painted? just picture, how did it play out? How did this killer goose kill three people? Like, did it get on top of them? Did it rip its brain out through their eye socket? Like,
gooses are assholes. If you ever, they will bite you. They are mean.
Yeah, they're mean. They're really mean.
Steve,
they'll peck you to death.
Steve, you know what I'm waiting for now? I'm waiting for a photo of a giant goose the size of an ostrich eating out of your bird feeder.
Yeah. I'm sure some listener out there will Photoshop for us and send
it. Did you guys realize that we stayed in Airbnbs in Oregon, and all the crew stayed in this beautiful Airbnb that was basically a big ranch, and they had alpacas, and I got to go pet an alpaca. Did you realize that alpacas are like waist high?
Really?
Whose waist?
Yeah, I was like, oh, it's like a pygmy alpaca, and she was like, no, this is just a regular alpaca, and I was like, no, alpacas are big, and she was like, no, those are llamas.
No. Okay.
And I had no idea.
No, there are multiple alpaca farms in Australia that I've been to, and they have llamas and alpacas, and there's not a huge difference in size between them.
These were tiny, and they were full grown, and I said they were pygmies, and she was like really adamant that I was wrong.
That's strange. I'm pretty sure I've seen alpacas.
Now I got to get to the bottom of this.
Let me see. I'm looking up alpaca on Wikipedia.
Oh, they even have their own Wikipedia. It's called Alpacapedia.
Yeah, look, alpaca 2.7 to 3.2 feet.
Ah, nice.
2.7 to 3.2 feet tall. They're tiny.
That's to their head?
That's to the withers. What's a withers?
To the wither?
Is that their?
To
I think that's their shoulder.
Maybe shoulder,
right?
Yeah. So shoulder, waist high to the shoulder. Okay.
Yeah,
it's like,
they're little.
It's like a it's like a Hector or a furlong.
I know. We got to add that. Withers squared. withers are the highest part of a horse's back, laying at the base of the neck above the shoulders.
Highest.
How can they measure
them
in hands like they measure horses? You'd think that that would be a...
Yeah, how many hands high is it?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. High. How many stone does it weigh?
Yeah, that's right.
Ugh. They are camelids. Camelids like camels and llamas.
Oh, they're so freaking cute. I'm going to send you guys a picture right now.
They are cute.
I still insist that there's nothing like smoots per fortnight.
No, you got us there around. That one's darn good. Tough to beat that
one. Oh, there's
the
pictures of a shorn alpaca. They look like aliens.
Awesome.
They do look like
a naked mole rat.
Skinny necks with this huge bobbly head on top. It's a...
Kill it before it breeds. Kill it.
Oh, my God. They're hilarious.
Plug shorn alpaca into Google and be rewarded. Okay. Evan, sometimes I regret the fact that this is audio only, you know, but whatever, we make do.
I know.
Evan, give us a quote.
Life is an unfoldment, and the further we travel, the more truth we can comprehend. To understand the things that are at our door is the best preparation for understanding those that lie beyond. Hypatia of Alexandria.
Yeah. She was Hypatia. Amazing. A mathematician, astronomer, inventor, philosopher, and of course the curator of the library, the last curator, right, of the Library of Alexandria.
The last one. Yep.
Killed by a mob. Killed by an angry mob of anti-intellectuals, whatever.
Terrible.
Changed the course of history.
But she was fantastic.
Bob, she ever make it into your forgotten superheroes of science?
Ooh, I don't think so.
All right, put her on the list.
Put her on the list. Get her on there.
Get her on the list. All right. Hey, Aron, thanks for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, man.
That was great. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're planning on, should we even say this? We have tentative plans to go back to Australia in 2019.
Oh, boy.
Yay.
I don't know if this makes it official or not, but those are our plans.
I'm sure we'll work something.
Force the hand, Steve. Force the hand.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
We'll work it out one way or the other.
We will.
But it's always good to see you guys from down under, our friends from halfway across the world.
It's always great to see you.
I miss Australia.
You know, there's always a place for you to stay if you come over.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thanks,
Aron. I'm totally going to bunk with Aron when I go down there.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
This was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org.
where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.